illustrate a case of loosely integrated collective superintelligence, imagine a planet, Mega Earth, which has the same level of communication and coordination technologies that we currently have on the real Earth, but with a population 1 million times as large. With such a huge population, the total intellectual workforce on Mega Earth would be correspondingly larger than on our planet. Suppose that a scientific genius of the caliber of a Newton or an Einstein arises at least once for every 10 billion people. Then, on Mega-Earth, there would be 700,000 such geniuses living contemporaneously, alongside proportionally vast multitudes of slightly lesser talents. New ideas and technologies would be developed at a furious pace, and global civilization on Mega-Earth would constitute a loosely integrated collective superintelligence. If we gradually increase the level of integration of a collective intelligence, it may eventually become a unified intellect, a single large mind, as opposed to a mere assemblage of loosely interacting smaller human minds. The inhabitants of Mega-Earth could take steps in that direction by improving communications and coordination technologies, and by developing better ways for many individuals to work on any hard intellectual problem together. A collective superintelligence could thus, after gaining sufficiently in integration, become a quality superintelligence. Quality superintelligence. We can distinguish a third form of superintelligence. Quality superintelligence. A system that is at least as fast as a human mind, and vastly qualitatively smarter. As with collective intelligence, intelligence quality is also a somewhat murky concept. And in this case, the difficulty is compounded by our lack of experience with any variations in intelligence quality above the upper end of the present human distribution. We can, however, get some grasp of the notion by considering some related cases. First, we can expand the range of our reference points by considering non-human animals, which have intelligence of lower quality. This is not meant as a speciesist remark. A zebrafish has a quality of intelligence that is excellently adapted to its ecological needs, but the relevant perspective here is a more anthropocentric one. Our concern is with performance on humanly relevant complex cognitive tasks. Non-human animals lack complex structured language. They are capable of no or only rudimentary tool use and tool construction. They are severely restricted in their ability to make long-term plans, and they have very limited abstract reasoning ability. Nor are these limitations fully explained by a lack of speed or of collective intelligence among non-human animal minds. In terms of raw computational power, human brains are probably inferior to those of some large animals, including elephants and whales. And although humanity's complex technological civilization would be impossible without our massive advantage in collective intelligence, not all distinctly human cognitive capabilities depend on collective intelligence. Many are highly developed even in small, isolated hunter-gatherer bands. And many are not nearly as highly developed among highly organized non-human animals, such as chimpanzees and dolphins, intensely trained by human instructors, or ants, living in their own large and well-ordered societies. Evidently, the remarkable intellectual achievements of Homo sapiens are to a significant extent attributable to specific features of our brain architecture, features that depend on a unique genetic endowment not shared by other animals. This observation can help us illustrate the concept of quality superintelligence. It is intelligence of quality at least as superior to that of human intelligence, as the quality of human intelligence is superior to that of elephants, dolphins, or chimpanzees. A second way to illustrate the concept of quality superintelligence is by noting the domain-specific cognitive deficits that can afflict individual humans, particularly deficits that are not caused by general dementia or other conditions associated with wholesale destruction of the brain's neurocomputational resources. Consider, for example, individuals with autism spectrum disorders who may have striking deficits in social cognition while functioning well in other cognitive domains. or individuals with congenital amusia who are unable to hum or recognize simple tunes, yet perform normally in most other respects. Many other examples could be adduced from the neuropsychiatric literature, which is replete with case studies of patients suffering narrowly circumscribed deficits caused by genetic abnormalities or brain trauma. Such examples show that normal human adults have a range of remarkable cognitive talents that are not simply a function of possessing a sufficient amount of general neural processing power, or even a sufficient amount of general intelligence. Specialized neural circuitry is also needed. This observation suggests the idea of possible but non-realized cognitive talents. Talents that no actual human possesses, even though other intelligent systems, ones with no more computing power than the human brain, that did have those talents, would gain enormously in their ability to accomplish a wide range of strategically relevant tasks. Accordingly, by considering non-human animals and human individuals with domain-specific cognitive deficits, we can form some notion of different qualities of intelligence and the practical difference they make. Had Homo sapiens lacked, for instance, the cognitive modules that enable complex linguistic representations, it might have been just another simian species living in harmony with nature. Conversely, were we to gain some new set of modules, giving an advantage comparable to that of being able to form complex linguistic representations, we would become superintelligent. Direct and indirect reach. Superintelligence in any of these forms could, over time, develop the technology necessary to create any of the others. The indirect reaches of these three forms of superintelligence are therefore equal. In that sense, the indirect reach of current human intelligence is also in the same equivalence class, under the supposition that we are able eventually to create some form of superintelligence. Yet there is a sense in which the three forms of superintelligence are much closer to one another. Any one of them could create other forms of superintelligence more rapidly than we can create any form of superintelligence from our present starting point. The direct reaches of the three different forms of superintelligence are harder to compare. There may be no definite ordering. Their respective capabilities depend on the degree to which they instantiate their respective advantages, how fast a speed superintelligence is, how qualitatively superior a quality superintelligence is, and so forth. At most, we might say that, ceteris paribus, speed superintelligence excels at tasks requiring the rapid execution of a long series of steps that must be performed sequentially, while collective superintelligence excels at tasks admitting of analytic decomposition into parallelizable subtasks and tasks demanding a combination of many different perspectives and skill sets. In some vague sense, quality superintelligence would be the most capable form of all, inasmuch as it could grasp and solve problems that are, for all practical purposes, beyond the direct reach of speed superintelligence and collective superintelligence. In some domains, quantity is a poor substitute for quality. One solitary genius working out of a cork-lined bedroom can write, "In Search of Lost Time." Could an equivalent masterpiece be produced by recruiting an office building full of literary hacks? Even within the range of present human variation, we see that some functions benefit greatly from the labor of one brilliant mastermind, as opposed to the joint efforts of myriad mediocrities. If we widen our purview to include superintelligent minds, we must countenance a likelihood of there being intellectual problems solvable only by superintelligence and intractable to any ever so large collective of non-augmented humans. There might thus be some problems that are solvable by a quality superintelligence, and perhaps by a speed superintelligence, yet which a loosely integrated collective superintelligence cannot solve, other than by first amplifying its own intelligence. We cannot clearly see what all these problems are, but we can characterize them in general terms. They would tend to be problems involving multiple complex interdependencies that do not permit of independently verifiable solution steps. Problems that therefore cannot be solved in a piecemeal fashion, and that might require qualitatively new kinds of understanding, or new representational frameworks that are too deep or too complicated for the current edition of mortals to discover or use effectively. Some types of artistic creation and strategic cognition might fall into this category. Some types of scientific breakthrough, perhaps, likewise. And one can speculate that the tardiness and wobbliness of humanity's progress on many of the eternal problems of philosophy are due to the unsuitability of the human cortex for philosophical work. On this view, our most celebrated philosophers are like dogs walking on their hind legs, just barely attaining the threshold level of performance required for engaging in the activity at all. Sources of advantage for digital intelligence. Minor changes in brain volume and wiring can have major consequences, as we see when we compare the intellectual and technological achievements of humans with those of other apes. The far greater changes in computing resources and architecture that machine intelligence will enable will probably have consequences that are even more profound. It is difficult, perhaps impossible, for us to form an intuitive sense of the aptitudes of a superintelligence, but we can at least get an inkling of the space of possibilities by looking at some of the advantages open to digital minds. The hardware advantages are easiest to appreciate. Speed of computational elements. Biological neurons operate at a peak speed of about 200 Hz, a full 7 orders of magnitude slower than a modern microprocessor, close to 2 GHz. As a consequence, the human brain is forced to rely on massive parallelization and is incapable of rapidly performing any computation that requires a large number of sequential operations. Anything the brain does in under a second cannot use much more than 100 sequential operations, perhaps only a few dozen. Yet many of the most practically important algorithms in programming and computer science are not easily parallelizable. Many cognitive tasks could be performed far more efficiently if the brain's native support for parallelizable pattern-matching algorithms were complemented by, and integrated with, support for fast sequential processing. Internal communication speed. Axons carry action potentials at speeds of 120 meters per second or less, whereas electronic processing cores can communicate optically at the speed of light, 300 million meters per second. The sluggishness of neural signals limits how big a biological brain can be while functioning as a single processing unit. For example, to achieve a round-trip latency of less than 10 milliseconds between any two elements in a system, biological brains must be smaller than 0.11 meters cubed. An electronic system, on the other hand, could be 6.1 times 10 to the power of 17 meters cubed, about the size of a dwarf planet, 18 orders of magnitude larger. Number of computational elements. The human brain has somewhat fewer than 100 billion neurons. Humans have about 3.5 times the brain size of chimpanzees, though only 1/5 the brain size of sperm whales. The number of neurons in a biological creature is most obviously limited by cranial volume and metabolic constraints. But other factors may also be significant for larger brains, such as cooling, development time, and signal conductance delays. See the previous point. By contrast, computer hardware is indefinitely scalable up to very high physical limits. Supercomputers can be warehouse-sized or larger, with additional remote capacity added via high-speed cables. Storage capacity. Human working memory is able to hold no more than some 4 or 5 chunks of information at any given time. While it would be misleading to compare the size of human working memory directly with the amount of RAM in a digital computer, it is clear that the hardware advantages of digital intelligences will make it possible for them to have larger working memories. This might enable such minds to intuitively grasp complex relationships that humans can only fumblingly handle be a plodding calculation. Human long-term memory is also limited, though it is unclear whether we manage to exhaust its storage capacity during the course of an ordinary lifetime. The rate at which we accumulate information is so slow. On one estimate, the adult human brain stores about 1 billion bits, a couple of orders of magnitude less than a low-end smartphone. Both the amount of information stored and the speed with which it can be accessed could thus be vastly greater in a machine brain than in a biological brain. Reliability, lifespan, sensors, etc. Machine intelligences might have various other hardware advantages. For example, biological neurons are less reliable than transistors. Since noisy computing necessitates redundant encoding schemes that use multiple elements to encode a single bit of information, a digital brain might derive some efficiency gains from the use of reliable, high-precision computing elements. Brains become fatigued after a few hours of work and start to permanently decay after a few decades of subjective time. Microprocessors are not subject to these limitations. Data flow into a machine intelligence could be increased by adding millions of sensors. Depending on the technology used, a machine might have reconfigurable hardware that can be optimized for changing task requirements, whereas much of the brain's architecture is fixed from birth or only slowly changeable, though the details of synaptic connectivity can change over shorter timescales, like days. At present, the computational power of the biological brain still compares favorably with that of digital computers, though top-of-the-line supercomputers are attaining levels of performance that are within the range of plausible estimates of the brain's processing power. But hardware is rapidly improving, and the ultimate limits of hardware performance are vastly higher than those of biological computing substrates. Digital minds will also benefit from major advantages in software. Editability. It is easier to experiment with parameter variations in software than in neural wetware. For example, with a whole brain emulation, one could easily trial what happens if one adds more neurons in a particular cortical area, or if one increases or decreases their excitability. Running such experiments in living biological brains would be far more difficult. Duplicability. With software, one can quickly make arbitrarily many high-fidelity copies to fill the available hardware base. Biological brains, by contrast, can be reproduced only very slowly, and each new instance starts out in a helpless state, remembering nothing of what its parents learned in their lifetimes. Goal coordination. Human collectives are replete with inefficiencies arising from the fact that it is nearly impossible to achieve complete uniformity of purpose among the members of a large group, at least until it becomes feasible to induce docility on a large scale by means of drugs or genetic selection. A copy clan, a group of identical or almost identical programs sharing a common goal, would avoid such coordination problems. Memory sharing. Biological brains need extended periods of training and mentorship, whereas digital minds could acquire new memories and skills by swapping data files. A population of 1 billion copies of an AI program could synchronize their databases periodically so that all the instances of the program know everything that any instance learned during the previous hour. Direct memory transfer requires standardized representational formats. Easy swapping of high-level cognitive content would therefore not be possible between just any pair of machine intelligences. In particular, it would not be possible among first-generation whole-brain emulations. New modules, modalities, and algorithms. Visual perception seems to us easy and effortless, quite unlike solving textbook geometry problems. This, despite the fact that it takes a massive amount of computation to reconstruct, from the two-dimensional patterns of stimulation on our retinas, a three-dimensional representation of a world populated with recognizable objects. The reason this seems easy is that we have dedicated low-level neural machinery for processing visual information. This Low-level processing occurs unconsciously and automatically, without draining our mental energy or conscious attention. Music perception, language use, social cognition, and other forms of information processing that are natural for us humans seem to be likewise supported by dedicated neurocomputational modules. An artificial mind that had such specialized support for other cognitive domains that have become important in the contemporary world, such as engineering, computer programming, and business strategy, would have big advantages over minds like ours that have to rely on clunky general-purpose cognition to think about such things. New algorithms may also be developed to take advantage of the distinct affordances of digital hardware, such as its support for fast serial processing. The ultimately attainable advantages of machine intelligence, hardware, and software combined are enormous. But how rapidly could those potential advantages be realized? That is the question to which we now turn. Chapter 4: The Kinetics of an Intelligence Explosion. Once machines attain some form of human equivalence in general reasoning ability, how long will it then be before they attain radical superintelligence? Will this be a slow, gradual, protracted transition, or will it be sudden, explosive? This chapter analyzes the kinetics of the transition to superintelligence as a function of optimization power and system recalcitrance. We consider that we know, or may reasonably surmise about the behavior of these two factors in the neighborhood of human-level general intelligence. Timing and speed of the takeoff. Given that machines will eventually vastly exceed biology in general intelligence, but that machine cognition is currently vastly narrower than human cognition, one is led to wonder how quickly this usurpation will take place. The question we are asking here must be sharply distinguished from the question we considered in Chapter 1 about how far away we currently are from developing a machine with human-level general intelligence. Here the question is instead, if and when such a machine is developed, how long will it be from then until a machine becomes radically superintelligent? Note that one could think that it will take quite a long time until machines reach the human baseline, or one might be agnostic about how long that will take, and yet have a strong view that once this happens, the further ascent into strong superintelligence will be very rapid. It can be helpful to think about these matters schematically, even though doing so involves temporarily ignoring some qualifications and complicating details. Consider, then, a diagram that plots the intellectual capability of the most advanced machine intelligence system as a function of time. A horizontal line labeled human baseline represents the effective intellectual capabilities of a representative human adult with access to the information sources and technological aids currently available in developed countries. At present, the most advanced AI system is far below the human baseline on any reasonable metric of general intellectual ability. At some point in future, a machine might reach approximate parity with this human baseline, which we take to be fixed, anchored to the year 2014, say, even if the capabilities of human individuals should have increased in the intervening years. This would mark the onset of the takeoff. The capabilities of the system continue to grow, and at some later point, the system reaches parity with the combined intellectual capability of all of humanity, again anchored to the present. What we may call the civilization baseline. Eventually, if the system's abilities continue to grow, it attains strong superintelligence, a level of intelligence vastly greater than contemporary humanity's combined intellectual wherewithal. The attainment of strong superintelligence marks the completion of the takeoff, though the system might continue to gain in capacity thereafter. Sometime during the takeoff phase, the system may pass a landmark, which we can call the crossover, a point beyond which the system's further improvement is mainly driven by the system's own actions rather than by work performed upon it by others. The possible existence of such a crossover will become important in the subsection on optimization power and explosivity later in this chapter. With this picture in mind, we can distinguish three classes of transition scenarios. Scenarios in which systems progress from human-level intelligence to superintelligence based on their steepness. That is to say, whether they represent a slow, fast, or moderate takeoff. Slow. A slow takeoff is one that occurs over some long temporal interval, such as decades or centuries. Slow takeoff scenarios offer excellent opportunities for human political processes to adapt and respond. Different approaches can be tried and tested in sequence. New experts can be trained and credentialed. Grassroots campaigns can be mobilized by groups that feel they are being disadvantaged by unfolding developments. If it appears that new kinds of secure infrastructure or mass surveillance of AI researchers is needed, such systems could be developed and deployed. Nations fearing an AI arms race would have time to try to negotiate treaties and design enforcement mechanisms. Most preparations undertaken before onset of the slow takeoff would be rendered obsolete as better solutions would gradually become visible in the light of the dawning era. Fast. A fast takeoff occurs over some short temporal interval, such as minutes, hours, or days. Fast takeoff scenarios offer scant opportunity for humans to deliberate. Nobody need even notice anything unusual before the game is already lost. In a fast takeoff scenario, humanity's fate essentially depends on preparations previously put in place. At the slowest end of the fast takeoff scenario range, some simple human actions might be possible, analogous to flicking open the nuclear suitcase. But any such action would either be elementary or have been planned and pre-programmed in advance. Moderate. A moderate takeoff is one that occurs over some intermediary temporal interval, such as months or years. Moderate takeoff scenarios give humans some chance to respond, but not much time to analyze the situation, to test different approaches, or to solve complicated coordination problems. There is not enough time to develop or deploy new systems, e.g., political systems, surveillance regimes, or computer network security protocols. But extant systems could be applied to the new challenge. During a slow takeoff, there would be plenty of time for the news to get out. In a moderate takeoff, by contrast, it is possible that developments would be kept secret as they unfold. Knowledge might be restricted to a small group of insiders, as if in a covert state-sponsored military research program. Commercial projects, small academic teams, and nine hackers in a basement outfits might also be clandestine. Though, if the prospect of an intelligence explosion were on the radar of state intelligence agencies as a national security priority, then the most promising private projects would seem to have a good chance of being under surveillance. The host state or a dominant foreign power would then have the option of nationalizing or shutting down any project that showed signs of commencing takeoff. Fast takeoffs would happen so quickly that there would not be much time for word to get out, or for anybody to mount a meaningful reaction if it did. But an outsider might intervene before the onset of the takeoff if they believed a particular project to be closing in on success. Moderate takeoff scenarios could lead to geopolitical, social, and economic turbulence as individuals and groups jockey to position themselves to gain from the unfolding transformation. Such upheaval, should it occur, might impede efforts to orchestrate a well-composed response. Alternatively, it might enable solutions more radical than calmer circumstances would permit. For instance, in a moderate takeoff scenario, where cheap and capable emulations or other digital mines gradually flood labor markets over a period of years, one could imagine mass protests by laid-off workers pressuring governments to increase unemployment benefits, or institute a living wage guarantee to all human citizens, or to levy special taxes or impose minimum wage requirements on employers who use emulation workers. In order for any relief derived from such policies to be more than fleeting, support for them would somehow have to be cemented into permanent power structures. Similar issues can arise if the takeoff is slow rather than moderate. But the disequilibrium and rapid change in moderate scenarios may present special opportunities for small groups to wield disproportionate influence. It might appear to some readers that of these three types of scenario, the slow takeoff is the most probable, the moderate takeoff is less probable, and the fast takeoff is utterly implausible. It could seem fanciful to suppose that the world could be radically transformed and humanity deposed from its position as apex cogitator over the course of an hour or two. No change of such moment has ever occurred in human history, and its nearest parallels, the agricultural and industrial revolutions, played out over much longer timescales, centuries to millennia in the former case, decades to centuries in the latter. So the base rate for the kind of transition entailed by a fast or medium takeoff scenario, in terms of the speed and magnitude of the postulated change, is zero. It lacks precedent outside myth and religion. Nevertheless, this chapter will present some reasons for thinking that the slow transition scenario is improbable. If and when a takeoff occurs, it will likely be explosive. To begin to analyze the question of how fast the takeoff will be, we can conceive of the rate of increase in a system's intelligence as a monotonically increasing function of two variables. The amount of optimization power, or quality-weighted design effort, that is being applied to increase the system's intelligence, and the responsiveness of the system to the application of a given amount of such optimization power. We might term the inverse of responsiveness recalcitrance, and write, rate of change in intelligence equals optimization power over recalcitrance. Pending some specification of how to quantify intelligence, design effort, and recalcitrance, this expression is merely qualitative. But we can at least observe that a system's intelligence will increase rapidly if either a lot of skilled effort is applied to the task of increasing its intelligence, and the system's intelligence is not too hard to increase, or there is a non-trivial design effort and the system's recalcitrance is low, or both. If we know how much design effort is going into improving a particular system, and the rate of improvement this effort produces, we could calculate the system's recalcitrance. Further, we can observe that the amount of optimization power devoted to improving some system's performance varies between systems and over time. A system's recalcitrance might also vary depending on how much the system has already been optimized. Often, the easiest improvements are made first, leading to diminishing returns, increasing recalcitrance, as low-hanging fruits are depleted. However, there can also be improvements that make further improvements easier, leading to improvement cascades. The process of solving a jigsaw puzzle starts out simple. It is easy to find the corners and the edges. Then recalcitrance goes up, as subsequent pieces are harder to fit. But as the puzzle nears completion, the search space collapses, and the process gets easier again. To proceed in our inquiry, we must therefore analyze how recalcitrance and optimization power might vary in the critical time periods during the takeoff. This will occupy us over the next few pages. Recalcitrance. Let us begin with recalcitrance. The outlook here depends on the type of the system under consideration. For completeness, we first cast a brief glance at the recalcitrance that will be encountered along paths to superintelligence that do not involve advanced machine intelligence. We find that recalcitrance along those paths appears to be fairly high. That done, we will turn to the main case, which is that the takeoff involves machine intelligence, and there we find that recalcitrance at the critical juncture seems low. Non-machine intelligence paths. Cognitive enhancement via improvements in public health and diet has steeply diminishing returns. Big gains come from eliminating severe nutritional deficiencies, and the most severe deficiencies have already been largely eliminated in all but the poorest countries. Only girth is gained by increasing an already adequate diet. Education, too, is now probably subject to diminishing returns. The fraction of talented individuals in the world who lack access to quality education is still substantial, but declining. Pharmacological enhancers might deliver some cognitive gains over the coming decades. But after the easiest fixes have been accomplished, perhaps sustainable increases in mental energy and ability to concentrate, along with better control over the rate of long-term memory consolidation, subsequent gains will be increasingly hard to come by. Unlike diet and public health approaches, however, improving cognition through smart drugs might get easier before it gets harder. The field of neuropharmacology still lacks much of the basic knowledge that would be needed to competently intervene in the healthy brain. Neglect of enhancement medicine as a legitimate area of research may be partially to blame for this current backwardness. If neuroscience and pharmacology continue to progress for a while longer without focusing on cognitive enhancement, then maybe there would be some relatively easy gains to be had when at last the development of nootropics becomes a serious priority. Genetic cognitive enhancement has a U-shaped recalcitrance profile similar to that of nootropics, but with larger potential gains. Recalcitrance starts out high, while the only available method is selective breeding sustained over many generations, something that is obviously difficult to accomplish on a globally significant scale. Genetic enhancement will get easier as technology is developed for cheap and effective genetic testing and selection, and particularly when iterated embryo selection becomes feasible in humans. These new techniques will make it possible to tap the pool of existing human genetic variation for intelligence-enhancing alleles. As the best existing alleles get incorporated into genetic enhancement packages, however, further gains will get harder to come by. The need for more innovative approaches to genetic modification may then increase recalcitrance. There are limits to how quickly things can progress along the genetic enhancement path, most notably the fact that germline interventions are subject to an inevitable maturational lag. This strongly counteracts the possibility of a fast or moderate takeoff. That embryo selection can only be applied in the context of in vitro fertilization will slow its rate of adoption, another limiting factor. The recalcitrance along the brain-computer path seems initially very high. In the unlikely event that it somehow becomes easy to insert brain implants and to achieve high-level functional integration with the cortex, recalcitrance might plummet. In the long run, the difficulty of making progress along this path would be similar to that involved in improving emulations or AIs, since the bulk of the brain-computer system's intelligence would eventually reside in the computer part. The recalcitrance for making networks and organizations in general more efficient is high. A vast amount of effort is going into overcoming this recalcitrance, and the result is an annual improvement of humanity's total capacity by perhaps no more than a couple of percent. Furthermore, shifts in the internal and external environment mean that organizations, even if efficient at one time, soon become ill-adapted to their new circumstances. Ongoing reform effort is thus required even just to prevent deterioration. A step change in the rate of gain in average organizational efficiency is perhaps conceivable, but it is hard to see how even the most radical scenario of this kind could produce anything faster than a slow takeoff, since organizations operated by humans are confined to work on human timescales. The internet continues to be an exciting frontier with many opportunities for enhancing collective intelligence, with a recalcitrance that seems at the moment to be in the moderate range. Progress is somewhat swift, but a lot of effort is going into making this progress happen. It may be expected to increase as low-hanging fruits, such as search engines and email, are depleted. Emulation and AI paths. The difficulty of advancing toward whole-brain emulation is difficult to estimate. Yet we can point to a specific future milestone, the successful emulation of an insect brain. That milestone stands on a hill, and its conquest would bring into view much of the terrain ahead, allowing us to make a decent guess at the recalcitrance of scaling up the technology to human whole brain emulation. A successful emulation of a small mammal brain, such as that of a mouse, would give an even better vantage point that would allow the distance remaining to a human whole brain emulation to be estimated with a high degree of precision. The path toward artificial intelligence, by contrast, may feature no such obvious milestone or early observation point. It is entirely possible that the quest for artificial intelligence will appear to be lost in dense jungle until an unexpected breakthrough reveals the finishing line in a clearing just a few short steps away. Recall the distinction between these two questions. How hard is it to attain roughly human levels of cognitive ability? And how hard is it to get from there to superhuman levels? The first question is mainly relevant for predicting how long it will be before the onset of a takeoff. It is the second question that is key to assessing the shape of the takeoff, which is our aim here. And though it might be tempting to suppose that the step from human level to superhuman level must be the harder one, this step, after all, takes place at a higher altitude, where capacity must be superadded to an already quite capable system. This would be a very unsafe assumption. It is quite possible that recalcitrance falls when a machine reaches human parity. Consider first whole brain emulation. The difficulties involved in creating the first human emulation are of a quite different kind from those involved in enhancing an existing emulation. Creating a first emulation involves huge technological challenges, particularly in regard to developing the requisite scanning and image interpretation capabilities. This step might also require considerable amounts of physical capital. An industrial-scale machine park with hundreds of high-throughput scanning machines is not implausible. By contrast, enhancing the quality of an existing emulation involves tweaking algorithms and data structures, essentially a software problem, and one that could turn out to be much easier than perfecting the imaging technology needed to create the original template. Programmers could easily experiment with tricks like increasing the neuron count in different cortical areas to see how it affects performance. They also could work on code optimization and on finding simpler computational models that preserve the essential functionality of individual neurons or small networks of neurons. If the last technological prerequisite to fall into place is either scanning or translation, with computing power being relatively abundant, then not much attention might have been given during the development phase to implementational efficiency, and easy opportunities for computational efficiency savings might be available. More fundamental architectural reorganization might also be possible, but that takes us off the emulation path and into AI territory. Another way to improve the code base once the first emulation has been produced is to scan additional brains with different or superior skills and talents. Productivity growth would also occur as a consequence of adapting organizational structures and workflows to the unique attributes of digital minds. Since there is no precedent in the human economy of a worker who can be literally copied, reset, run at different speeds, and so forth, managers of the first emulation cohort would find plenty of room for innovation in managerial practices. After initially plummeting when human whole brain emulation becomes possible, recalcitrance may rise again. Sooner or later, the most glaring implementational inefficiencies will have been optimized away, the most promising algorithmic variations will have been tested, and the easiest opportunities for organizational innovation will have been exploited. The template library will have expanded so that acquiring more brain scans would add little benefit over working with existing templates. Since a template can be multiplied, each copy can be individually trained in a different field, and this can be done at electronic speed. It might be that the number of brains that would need to be scanned in order to capture most of the potential economic gains is small, possibly a single brain, would suffice. Another potential cause of escalating recalcitrance is the possibility that emulations or their biological supporters will organize to support regulations restricting the use of emulation workers, limiting emulation copying, prohibiting certain kinds of experimentation with digital minds, instituting workers' rights, and a minimum wage for emulations, and so forth. It is equally possible, however, that political developments would go in the opposite direction, contributing to a fall in recalcitrance. This might happen if initial restraint in the use of emulation labor gives way to unfettered exploitation as competition heats up and the economic and strategic costs of occupying the moral high ground become clear. As for artificial intelligence, non-emulation machine intelligence, the difficulty of lifting a system from human level to superhuman level by means of algorithmic improvements depends on the attributes of the particular system. Different architectures might have very different recalcitrance. In some situations, recalcitrance could be extremely low. For example, if human-level AI is delayed because one key insight long eludes programmers, then when the final breakthrough occurs, the AI might leapfrog from below to radically above human level without even touching the intermediary rungs. Another situation in which recalcitrance could turn out to be extremely low is that of an AI system that can achieve intelligent capability via two different modes of processing. To illustrate this possibility, suppose an AI is composed of two subsystems, one possessing domain-specific problem-solving techniques, the other possessing general-purpose reasoning ability. It could then be the case that while the second subsystem remains below a certain capacity threshold, it contributes nothing to the system's overall performance, because the solutions it generates are always inferior to those generated by the domain-specific subsystem. Suppose now that a small amount of optimization power is applied to the general-purpose subsystem, and that this produces a brisk rise in the capacity of that subsystem. At first, we observe no increase in the overall system's performance, indicating that recalcitrance is high. Then, once the capacity of the general-purpose subsystem crosses the threshold where its solutions start to beat those of the domain-specific subsystem, the overall system's performance suddenly begins to improve at the same brisk pace as the general-purpose subsystem, even as the amount of optimization power applied stays constant. The system's recalcitrance has plummeted. It is also possible that our natural tendency to view intelligence from an anthropocentric perspective will lead us to underestimate improvements in subhuman systems, and thus to overestimate recalcitrance. Eliezer Yudkowsky, an AI theorist who has written extensively on the future of machine intelligence, puts the point as follows. AI might make an apparently sharp jump in intelligence purely as the result of anthropomorphism, the human tendency to think of village idiot and Einstein as the extreme ends of the intelligence scale, instead of nearly indistinguishable points on the scale of minds in general. Everything dumber than a dumb human may appear to us as simply dumb. One imagines the AI arrow creeping steadily up the scale of intelligence, moving past mice and chimpanzees, with AIs still remaining dumb, because AIs cannot speak fluent language or write science papers. And then, the AI arrow crosses the tiny gap from infra-idiot to ultra-Einstein in the course of 1 month or some similarly short period. See Figure 8. The upshot of these several considerations is that it is difficult to predict how hard it will be to make algorithmic improvements in the first AI that reaches a roughly human level of general intelligence. There are at least some possible circumstances in which algorithm recalcitrance is low. But even if algorithm recalcitrance is very high, this would not preclude the overall recalcitrance of the AI in question from being low. For it might be easy to increase the intelligence of the system in other ways than by improving its algorithms. There are two other factors that can be improved: content and hardware. First, consider content improvements. By content, we here mean those parts of a system's software assets that do not make up its core algorithmic architecture. Content might include, for example, databases of stored percepts, specialized skills libraries, and inventories of declarative knowledge. For many kinds of system, the distinction between algorithmic architecture and content is very unsharp. Nevertheless, it will serve as a rough and ready way of pointing to one potentially important source of capability gains in a machine intelligence. An alternative way of expressing much the same idea is by saying that a system's intellectual problem-solving capacity can be enhanced not only by making the system cleverer, but also by expanding what the system knows. Consider a contemporary AI system such as TextRunner, a research project at the University of Washington, or IBM's Watson, the system that won the Jeopardy quiz show. These systems can extract certain pieces of semantic information by analyzing text. Although these systems do not understand what they read in the same sense or to the same extent as a human does, they can nevertheless extract significant amounts of information from natural language and use that information to make simple inferences and answer questions. They can also learn from experience, building up more extensive representations of a concept as they encounter additional instances of its use. They are designed to operate for much of the time in unsupervised mode, i.e., to learn hidden structure in unlabeled data in the absence of error or reward signal, without human guidance, and to be fast and scalable. TextRunner, for instance, works with a corpus of 500 million web pages. Now imagine a remote descendant of such a system that has acquired the ability to read with as much understanding as a human 10-year-old, but with a reading speed similar to that of TextRunner. This is probably an AI-complete problem. So we are imagining a system that thinks much faster and has much better memory than a human adult, but knows much less. And perhaps the net effect of this is that the system is roughly human equivalent in its general problem-solving ability, but its content recalcitrance is very low. Low enough to precipitate a takeoff. Within a few weeks, the system has read and mastered all the content contained in the Library of Congress. Now the system knows much more than any human being and thinks vastly faster. It has become at least weakly superintelligent. A system might thus greatly boost its effective intellectual capability by absorbing pre-produced content accumulated through centuries of human science and civilization. For instance, by reading through the internet. If an AI reaches human level without previously having had access to this material, or without having been able to digest it, then the AI's overall recalcitrance will be low, even if it is hard to improve its algorithmic architecture. Content recalcitrance is a relevant concept for emulations too. A high-speed emulation has an advantage, not only because it can complete the same tasks as biological humans more quickly, but also because it can accumulate more timely content, such as task-relevant skills and expertise. In order to tap the full potential of fast content accumulation, however, a system needs to have a correspondingly large memory capacity. There is little point in reading an entire library if you have forgotten all about the aardvark by the time you get to the abalone. While an AI system is likely to have adequate memory capacity, emulations would inherit some of the capacity limitations of their human templates. They may therefore need architectural enhancements in order to become capable of unbounded learning. So far, we have considered the recalcitrance of architecture and of content. That is, how difficult it would be to improve the software of a machine intelligence that has reached human parity. Now let us look at a third way of boosting the performance of machine intelligence: improving its hardware. What would be the recalcitrance for hardware-driven improvements? Starting with intelligent software, emulation or AI, one can amplify collective intelligence simply by using additional computers to run more instances of the program. One could also amplify speed intelligence by moving the program to faster computers. Depending on the degree to which the program lends itself to parallelization, speed intelligence could also be amplified by running the program on more processors. This is likely to be feasible for emulations, which have a highly parallelized architecture. But many AI programs, too, have important subroutines that can benefit from massive parallelization. Amplifying quality intelligence by increasing computing power might also be possible, but that case is less straightforward. The recalcitrance for amplifying collective or speed intelligence, and possibly quality intelligence, in a system with human-level software is therefore likely to be low. The only difficulty involved is gaining access to additional computing power. There are several ways for a system to expand its hardware base, each relevant over a different timescale. In the short term, computing power should scale roughly linearly with funding. Twice the funding buys twice the number of computers, enabling twice as many instances of the software to be run simultaneously. The emergence of cloud computing services gives a project the option to scale up its computational resources without even having to wait for new computers to be delivered and installed, though concerns over secrecy might favor the use of in-house computers. In certain scenarios, computing power could also be obtained by other means, such as by commandeering botnets. Just how easy it would be to scale the system by a given factor depends on how much computing power the initial system uses. A system that initially runs on a PC could be scaled by a factor of thousands for a mere $1 million. A program that runs on a supercomputer would be far more expensive to scale. In the slightly longer term, the cost of acquiring additional hardware may be driven up as a growing portion of the world's installed capacity is being used to run digital mines. For instance, in a competitive market-based emulation scenario, the cost of running one additional copy of an emulation should rise to be roughly equal to the income generated by the marginal copy, as investors bid up the price for existing computing infrastructure to match the return they expect from their investment. Though if only one project has mastered the technology, it might gain a degree of monopsony power in the computing power market, and therefore pay a lower price. Over a somewhat longer timescale, the supply of computing power will grow as new capacity is installed. A demand spike would spur production in existing semiconductor foundries and stimulate the construction of new plants. A one-off performance boost, perhaps amounting to one or two orders of magnitude, might also be attainable by using customized microprocessors. Above all, the rising wave of technology improvements will pour increasing volumes of computational power into the turbines of the thinking machines. Historically, the rate of improvement of computing technology has been described by the famous Moore's Law, which in one of its variations states that computing power per dollar doubles every 18 months or so. Although one cannot bank on this rate of improvement continuing up to the development of human-level machine intelligence, yet until fundamental physical limits are reached, there will remain room for advances in computing technology. There are thus reasons to expect that hardware recalcitrance will not be very high. Purchasing more computing power for the system, once it proves its mettle, by attaining human-level intelligence, might easily add several orders of magnitude of computing power, depending on how hardware frugal the project was before expansion. Chip customization might add one or two orders of magnitude. Other means of expanding the hardware base, such as building more factories and advancing the frontier of computing technology, take longer, normally several years, though this lag would be radically compressed once machine superintelligence revolutionizes manufacturing and technology development. In summary, we can talk about the likelihood of a hardware overhang. When human-level software is created, enough computing power may already be available to run vast numbers of copies at great speed. Software recalcitrance, as discussed above, is harder to assess, but might be even lower than hardware recalcitrance. In particular, There may be content overhang in the form of pre-made content, e.g. the internet, that becomes available to a system once it reaches human parity. Algorithm overhang. Breeders